So I was born in Chicago, grew up in California. My grandparents were immigrants to the US, mostly from Russia, Belarus, Ukraine, and Poland. And my parents were the first generation born in the States. So I grew up in California, and my family was Jewish. The community I grew up in was Christian, so I had friends of both religions. I grew up during the middle of the Vietnam War, which had a very powerful effect on me because I was wondering if we want to live in peace together, how come we kill each other? Because that's what the government was saying. We're fighting a war for peace. Right. I wondered what happens after you die. What's the purpose of being alive? What it means to love somebody? I had all these kinds of questions, and I asked, various teachers and religious leaders in the community I grew up with. I couldn't find any answers that really satisfied me. I went to Sunday school when I was a child, and then I also had a Catholic boyfriend, so I learned about both Judaism and Christianity. But the more I learned about God, the less I believed in God. It just didn't make any sense to me. Now, I'm not criticizing people who believe in God because maybe for them it's a beneficial belief and it makes sense. But for me, it didn't make any sense. I couldn't understand why God created everything. And if God created everything, why didn't he do a better job? Why is there suffering? If God is powerful, why is there suffering? If God is compassionate, why is there suffering? And they say, well, God wants us to learn from the suffering. I say, why didn't he create us more intelligent so we didn't have to learn from suffering? And I didn't see very many people learning from their suffering. I saw most people inflicting suffering, So I couldn't find an answer in the religions that had a God. It just never made sense to me from the time I was, quite young. When I went away to university, I still had all those questions. I studied history. When I changed my major a bunch of times, when I finally decided on something, it was history. And in studying history, I learned that every generation in Europe, people were fighting a war, usually in the name of God. People for centuries have been killing each other over religion. And I couldn't figure out why. I got a little bit cynical. Cynicism is not a very good mental state, but that's where I was, And I thought if religion just makes humans suffer more because it causes them to quarrel more, then what's the purpose? So I kind of abandoned religion at that point. And I did what many young Americans did in the 60s and 70s, which would probably horrify a lot of you, so I won't go into I remember one time years ago, I was talking to a group of NTU students, and they got me somehow talking about this part of my life. And afterwards, one of them looked at me and he said, "Wow, Venerable, you've changed a lot." Okay, so we don't come out of our mother's womb in robes as nuns, or monks. Yeah. We have ordinary lives and do all the things that ordinary people do. Anyway, after I finished university, I worked for a year, and I still didn't know what the purpose of life was. But I was tired of studying about life and I wanted to learn about it. So I took off and I traveled. And I traveled in Eastern Europe and Western Europe, across North Africa, spent some time in Israel, and then flew to Turkey and went overland to India through Iran and through Afghanistan. and Pakistan and into India and Nepal. So I'm familiar with those parts of the world. When I got to India, a friend of mine had learned to meditate, I think some kind of Hindu meditation, but she was really glowing, and she talked to me about meditation. I still never did it while I was in India, but she got me interested. But I did come back from Nepal with a lot of different Buddhist figures. There's these woodblock prints of different deities. I had no idea what they meant. Okay, I had no knowledge or faith in the Buddha, but I like these pictures. And so I got them and I brought them back so that in my flat in America I would have all these far out things from Nepal. So my friends would all go, "Wow, you've been to Nepal?" So my initial motivation for getting them was not benevolent, it was egotistical. But I got back to LA, still not knowing what life was about, but thought, I don't know what the meaning of life is, but it must have something to do with benefiting others. So what is a profession that's going to benefit others? And I thought, teaching. Because if we're going to create a better society, we need education and we need to teach children how to be good human beings. And I still think that children need to learn how to become good human beings more than they need to learn math and science and reading and writing, personally speaking. Okay. So I went back to graduate school at University of Southern California and started teaching school in Los Angeles. By the way, in my undergrad days, I went to USC for 2 years when O.J. Simpson was there. I had a boyfriend who liked football games. I've never understood football. I think watching what balls do as they bounce around, people get so excited about what balls do. Anyway, I wasn't very interested in him, but I really liked this guy. So he wanted to go to the football game, the USC football game with O.J. Simpson. So I was sitting there in the crowd, and O.J. is the quarterback or whatever he was, and everybody's counting on him to score for the team. And so the whole crowd is yelling, "Kill, kill, kill." That's, how you do your cheerleading for the football team. I thought that was very interesting years later. That what people were yelling to him 20 years before was kill, kill. Anyway, I've had to get distracted by that. So I started teaching school, and I found a flyer about a meditation course at a bookstore one day. Okay. Now, for any of you who ever do volunteer work in Buddhist centers and wonder about if what you're doing makes any difference in people's life, I am sitting here right now as a nun because somebody put a flyer in a bookstore. Because somebody put that flyer in the bookstore. So that flyer announced a talk by one, American nun in the Tibetan tradition, and some retreats by some Tibetan lamas. So I went to the talk by this nun, and it was very interesting. She was talking about Nepal and Tibetans, and I was always interested in this kind of stuff. And she seemed like a really nice person, which was kind of totally the opposite of my conception of what nuns were. Okay, because I grew up pre-Vatican II, before the reforms in the Vatican Church, so Catholic nuns were the only thing we knew about, and they didn't have a, Catholic monks and nuns didn't have a real good reputation among children. Okay, because they were your teachers and they would hit you. So here was a Buddhist nun who was friendly, and I thought, oh, this is very interesting. So I went to the retreat, that these two lamas were teaching. One was Lama Sopa Rinpoche, and the other was Lama Tukten Yeshe. Okay? And one of the first things they said in the course was, you don't need to believe anything we say. So I thought, good, I'll listen. Because by that time in my life, I was tired of people telling me the truth with a capital T. And if they would have told me, we have the truth, we can solve your problems, we're going to answer your questions and give you the good news about how you have to be, I would have said, bye bye. Okay? Because I just wasn't into anybody telling me what I should believe. So then, you know, they said, you don't have to believe anything. You listen. You know, you're intelligent people. You think about it. You see if it makes sense to you. Check it out logically. Apply it in your life and see if it works. And then you decide based on, you know, your own investigation and your own experience. So I really like that approach very, very much, because there was total space to make up my own mind about what I thought about Buddhism. So I went to this retreat. It was 3 weeks in Southern California, not too far from where I lived. I came back, and because it was summer vacation, you know, I wasn't working. So I did another retreat with some friends where we were basically meditating most of the day. And during that retreat, I started to have a very strong feeling that I wanted to learn more about Buddhism, and if I didn't, then I would regret it at the end of my life. And I've always felt that I, you know, I don't want to die with regret. I don't want to die thinking that I should have done something different in my life, or that I passed by an opportunity, or that I made a huge mistake. I've always felt like, you know, I want to think about things and make good decisions. When I make a mess, clean it up right away, and really do what feels to be the best thing to me to do. Okay? So I had that strong feeling about I have to learn more about Buddhism. This was 1975 in America. So there was very little access to Buddhism there. There were some Buddhist temples, but the people in them spoke Chinese or Japanese or Vietnamese, and I didn't know any of those languages. Okay? The lamas had a center, Kopan Monastery in Nepal, that had space for Westerners to go to. So I thought, you know, I'll go there. So I quit my job, you know, instead of going back to teach that autumn, I quit my job and I went to Nepal. Meanwhile, my parents are going, you know, kind of, we thought you got all your traveling out of your system earlier, and, you know, and I did well in school, and so they expected me to kind of, you know, do the whole thing. But I felt, you know, I want to go to Nepal and I want to learn this. So I did. So in the community at Kopan, we heard teachings and we, you know, meditated together as a community, practiced together as a community. We practiced on our own. We had work to do in the community and really lived a life together and worked together. So in the course of being there, I thought, you know, I would really like to ordain. Why I wanted to ordain was I wanted to devote my life to the spiritual path, to the Buddhist path. And it still seems to me that ordination, it was one of the best ways to really do that, because I knew if I had a family, it would be difficult, you know, because, I mean, if I had a husband and kids, I couldn't be here now teaching you. You know, my husband would be complaining, I want you to be with me, you know. See? <Huh? laughs> So, you know, I thought, okay, ordination is a way just for me to really, you know, not have so many distractions to my spiritual practice. And also, I knew by looking at my life that I wasn't always very consistent in my ethical discipline. Okay? In other words, I had kind of a double standard. When other people lied, I thought it was terrible. But when I lied, it was for a good reason. And it was actually to benefit and protect other people. Right? Yeah? You know? When other people got nasty and said horrible things to other people, it was awful. But when I did that, it was okay because they deserved it. Okay? So I began to see that I wasn't very consistent in how I was living my life. I had one ideal of ethical values, but, you know, I always renegotiated them when my ego wanted it. Okay? So I realized that, you know, I couldn't go through my whole life like this. I had to start being more consistent and living the way, living more according to the values that I espoused. I mean, I knew I couldn't do it perfectly, but I wanted to try. Okay? And so I went to Lama Yeshe towards the end of 1975 and asked him if I could ordain. And Lama said, "Yes, dear." He called everybody dear. He said, "Yes, dear, but wait a while." Well, I didn't want to wait a while. I wanted to do it right away. But, you know, when your teacher tells you something, you listen. So actually, now looking back on it, I think Lama was incredibly wise in making me wait, because I had to go back to America and answer to my family, who, you know, and my family by this point were totally freaking out, you know. It's like, "You're going to become a what?" Yeah. I mean, they had never heard of Buddhism before. They thought I was joining a cult. Yeah? And their daughter, who had, you know, long, beautiful hair down to her waist, was going to shave it off. Yeah? No grandchildren. Yeah? What are they going to tell their friends? You know, she's going from America to live in Nepal, where they don't even have flush toilets. You know, what's she doing that for? So, you know, I had to deal with my family, who, you know, didn't understand at all what I was doing. They thought I was just totally nuts. They finally realized that it's not a phase. They thought for a long time it was just a phase and I would grow out of it. You know, 25 years later, they recognize it's not a phase. Okay, but, you know, it was quite difficult for my family, and I wasn't especially skilled as a young person in explaining it well to them, so I have to take responsibility for that. Anyway, in the spring of 77, the Lamas came to teach in the States again, and I went and again requested ordination. And this is about nearly a year and a half after I had first requested. And they said yes, and I would go back to Nepal, and Kyabje Ling Rinpoche, who at that time was the senior tutor of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, was my abbot and my ordination master. So I ordained in Dharamsala in the spring of 1977, and I stayed in Nepal and India training the initial years. Then, as my teachers were asked by their Western students to set up Dharma centers in other countries, they asked their senior students to go and live in those centers. So I wound up living in Italy for nearly 2 years at a center there, came back to India, went to France, and I was living in a monastery there for 3 years, came back to India. Then I was asked to go teach in Hong Kong, and I did that, and from there went to Taiwan, where I took the full ordination, because the full ordination lineage doesn't exist in the Tibetan tradition, so I had to take it in Taiwan. And so at that time I really became exposed to Chinese Buddhism in a quite wonderful way, and I have a lot of respect for that tradition. I came back to India. By now this is 1987. And I went to Tibet at that point, spent 3 months in Tibet. And upon leaving Tibet, I came back to Nepal, and I was going to go do a three-month retreat in the mountains in Nepal. As I was arranging my things to go do this three-month retreat, I got a message from my teacher, and it said, "Go to Singapore and teach." And I said, "Teach what? I don't know anything, you know." And I want to do retreat. But anyway, again, when your teacher tells you to do something, you know. So I came to Singapore. I knew one person when I came to Singapore. When I had taken ordination in Taiwan, there was one Singaporean nun there. So she was from Taipeiian, the just up the road, yeah. So on off Balestier. And so I wound up staying at that temple, and I went there. Venerable Phat Quan, who was the abbess there, and whose kindness, you know, it's due to her kindness that we have this building, because she's the one who organized the building of Taipei Buddhist Center. I mean, she's made incredible contributions to Buddhism in this country. And, you know, so she was the abbess there. I stayed there for a while. And then I was teaching with ABC, Amitabha Buddhist Center, except it wasn't ABC at that time. It was this loose band of people. We didn't even have a name. And we didn't have our own place. And we were meeting sometimes in Paya Lebar, and sometimes on Riverside Road, and sometimes in Geelong. I mean, really, the homeless life, you know? We were just going all around. And then also my living condition. I lived in 6 places in 15 months, yeah, in Singapore. But I'm very grateful to all those people who took me in during that time, yeah? Because the center was new, and, you know, Buddhism was in Singapore was very different than it is now. So I was in Singapore for, like I said, about 15 months, and then I went on to visit my parents. And I had only intended to go for a short time to see my parents and then come back to Singapore. But when some people in the States asked me if I would do a teaching tour in the States, and at first I said, I think you have the wrong person, not me. And then they said, no, we really want you to do it. I said, well, okay. And they arranged a teaching tour for, I forget, 4 or 5 months, something like that, going to many centers around the States. And I was very surprised, because I hadn't been in America for about 8 or 9 years by that time. And I was very surprised at the change in the country and to see that there was a lot of interest in Buddhism in America. Because before, when I lived there, nobody knew about it. And so by this time, it was 1989, people were interested, and there were centers and teachings happening. So I wound up staying in the States for about a year then. And then I came back to Singapore for a few months and went on to Dharamsala, India to study. By that time, Venerable Sangha Khandra had come and was the resident teacher here at ABC. She's a very good friend of mine. So I was back in India for a year, and then I came back and I was in Singapore, Malaysia for a few months. Then I went back to the States, and again, I was on another teaching tour in the States. And at that time, I went through Seattle. I had been in Seattle in the 89 teaching tour, and I came back in the 91 teaching tour. And the people there, they didn't have a resident teacher. They asked me if I would stay and be their resident teacher. Okay, and I said, well, I don't work for a living, and so, you know, you would need to support me. Now, that may seem very funny for you people to think that a nun has to say, but in America, people don't understand what Sangha is, you know. They don't understand. They think either that there's a big church that supports you, or you go and you work 9 to 5, or you eat air. I don't know, you know, but they don't think. So, you know, I had to say, you know, if you could support me. So then they kind of had crisis, you know. Can we support her? So they had a bunch of meetings together, you know. And I think at the end they said, well, it doesn't look like she eats too much. You know, she wears the same clothes every day. No jewelry, no makeup, no television, you know. So, yeah, maybe we can do it. Actually, they were quite kind and generous. I was, you know, playing there. But so I stayed in Seattle, and you know, with a center called Dharma Friendship Foundation, which also I have some kind of karma that I am always with things at the beginning. Okay, the Italian center, it was the beginning. The French monastery at the beginning. Yeah, the Hong Kong center at the beginning. Singapore at the beginning. Dharma Friendship Fund at the beginning. Some karma, you know, we're always there at the beginning. So we started off, we rented a house. I lived in one room, and then the living room was our meeting place. And we were there for 4 years, and then we were getting too big, and also I needed my personal space, and so we moved and we rented another facility. We rented a commercial space that we used for the temple, and then they rented a flat that was about a mile away where I could live. The group doesn't have a lot of money, so we couldn't purchase a place. So I've been in Seattle for 10, coming on 10 years now, you know, quite a while. And that was my main base. I would always travel to various places when people invited me to teach. So I came back to Singapore, you know, several times in the last 10 years. I would try to go to India every year and also see my teachers, because living as the only nun in the middle of a city, always surrounded by lay people, is quite difficult. And so I needed to be with a Sangha community at least for a few weeks every year. I began to go to Israel to teach also. There were young Israelis that I met in India who invited me to go to the Middle East to teach, and so I've been doing that. I was supposed to go this spring, and I was also supposed to go again this autumn, but both trips were postponed because of the political situation. I wound up teaching in Mexico and El Salvador. I'm going to Guatemala soon. So various places, you know, in other countries and also in the States.